A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's reflecting on our last episode about Israeli political dysfunction, and he's asking a bigger question. He points to the recent cuts to civil defense alongside expanded subsidies for yeshiva students who avoid military service, and he notes that even right-wing voters are starting to feel disillusioned. His question is, what are examples of other countries where a similar moment of mass distrust in leadership emerged? And what kind of political systems did they end up with after their revolutions? He's wondering whether a democratic revolution in Israel is possible, and what it might actually look like. It's a comparative politics question with a very specific personal stake.
It's well-timed, because the polling data from the Israel Democracy Institute's May survey really sharpens the question. 62% of right-wing voters now express disappointment with the current coalition. That's up from 41% in January. When a government's own base starts turning on it, something structural is cracking. That's not trimming around the edges. That's a direct trade-off between national security and coalition maintenance.
These are voters in places like Ashdod, Beersheba, the settlements in the West Bank, people who have voted Likud or further right for decades. When you lose them, you don't just lose an election. You lose the permission structure that made your coalition possible in the first place.
And the specific moves that triggered this. The civil defense budget cut by 18% in April, from 4.2 billion shekels down to 3.45 billion, while in the same Knesset session, they expanded childcare subsidies for yeshiva students who avoid military service, costing an estimated 1.8 billion shekels annually. These are Likud voters, religious Zionist voters, the core constituency. When those numbers move 14 points in 3 months, something is shifting beneath the surface.
You do them back to back in the same session, so every journalist and every voter can draw a straight line from the cut to the handout.
It's not even hidden. The government effectively announced, we will spend less on protecting everyone and more on subsidizing the lifestyle of a specific constituency that exempts itself from the shared burden, and they did it in one afternoon. The civil defense cut affects every Israeli municipality. It means fewer bomb shelters being maintained, fewer emergency supplies stockpiled, slower response times for rocket attacks. These aren't abstract line items. In Sderot, where residents have 15 seconds to reach a shelter when the sirens go off, the maintenance of those shelters is literally life and death.
The yeshiva subsidies, they go to families where the men are engaged in full-time Torah study and are legally exempt from the very military service that is supposed to protect Sderot.
The purpose of government has shifted from serving citizens to serving ideological blocs. And that's the structural problem. It predates Netanyahu. It'll likely outlast him.
That's the setup. Israel isn't the first country to reach this kind of boiling point, though. Let's look at three very different cases where mass distrust in leadership boiled over and see what happened next.
We would protect Israel better. We would be tougher on Iran. They don't offer a vision for depoliticizing the civil service, reforming the electoral system, or rebalancing power between the branches. They're playing the same game, just from the other side of the field.
To be fair to them for a moment, there's a reason they do that. National security is the one language that still reaches right-wing voters who are disillusioned with the coalition.
Within weeks, you had over 1 million people in the streets of Santiago. The slogan was, no son 30 pesos, son 30 años. It's not 30 pesos, it's 30 years. By November 15th, the political class signed an agreement to begin a constitutional process. They held a plebiscite in October 2020, 78% voted to draft a new constitution. They elected a constitutional convention. They're fishing in the same pond with the same bait. And the entire system has shifted from serving citizens to serving ideological blocs. Both sides are fine with the rules of that game. They just want to be the ones winning it.
Which brings us to the core question. When a democracy's institutions become so detached from citizen welfare that even the ruling coalition's base is disillusioned, What comes next? And what can other countries' revolutionary outcomes teach us?
To understand what might happen next, it helps to look at other countries that have been through similar moments. Let's start with Hungary. The convention had produced a document that was arguably the most progressive constitution ever drafted. It would have recognized the rights of nature, guaranteed gender parity in government, recognized indigenous nations. And the population looked at it and said, no thank you.
By 2010, trust in the entire post-communist political establishment had evaporated.
I want to pause on that tape because it's worth understanding just how devastating it was. This wasn't a leaked memo or an anonymous source. This was the Prime Minister's own voice, recorded at a closed party meeting, saying, and I'm paraphrasing, we lied throughout the campaign. We lied about the economy, we lied about taxes, we lied about everything. And we did it because we had to win. When that recording hit the airwaves, it wasn't just a scandal. It was a confirmation of every cynical suspicion Hungarians had about their political class.
Into that vacuum walked Viktor Orbán. Chile ended up with a more moderate reform path, not a revolution, which is in some ways a success story, but also a demonstration of how existing institutions can defang a movement.
In 2011, his government passed the new fundamental law, replacing the 1949 constitution. It was drafted exclusively by Fidesz. The opposition boycotted the vote entirely.
A party that won an election rewrote the entire constitutional order with zero input from anyone else. And here's the thing, I remember the international coverage at the time, and a lot of it was weirdly bloodless. Hungary's parliament passes new constitution. As if this were a routine legislative update, and not a complete restructuring of the state by one party.
The international reaction was mostly shrugs, because technically, procedurally, it was legal. They had the votes.
Not just failed, the old elites absorbed it, Hezbollah sent counter-protesters, the system froze. The state is now effectively bankrupt. The currency has lost over 90% of its value, and the same families who've run Lebanon since the civil war are still in charge.
What's the mechanism? In Lebanon, the sectarian elites are the system. There's no independent institutional layer that can mediate between protesters and power. The banks are owned by the political families. The judiciary is captured. And the mechanism that makes it work is what political scientists call abusive constitutionalism. You use the forms of constitutional democracy to hollow out its substance.
In Chile, there was a constitutional tradition, an independent electoral service, a civil society infrastructure that could channel protest energy into a process. Let me give a concrete example of how this plays out in practice, because tilting the playing field can sound abstract.
That's the nightmare scenario for any mass movement, not defeat, absorption. The protest happens, it's enormous, it's beautiful, it's cross-sectarian, and then 6 months later, everything is worse and the same people are in charge.
In the 2022 election, Fidesz won 54% of the vote, but took 68% of the seats.
This one is remarkable. President Park Geun-hye, a corruption scandal breaks. She's allegedly colluding with a confidant, Choi Soon Sil, who had no official position but was influencing policy and extracting money from conglomerates. That's the insidious elegance of the model. You don't need to steal elections. You just need to design a system where winning 54% of the vote reliably produces a supermajority.
The Rasputin of Seoul.
The anger wasn't manufactured. But the revolution that emerged from that anger didn't lead to better governance. It led to one-party control dressed up in democratic language. On December 9th, the National Assembly voted to impeach Park, 234 votes to 56.
The key detail is that the system held. The impeachment went to the Constitutional Court, which upheld it in March 2017. Park was removed. A snap election was held within 60 days. Moon Jae-in won and took office. Chile is fascinating and deeply sobering. In October 2019, the government announced a 30 peso metro fare hike in Santiago. That's about 4 US cents.
South Korea didn't get a new constitution. It didn't get electoral reform. It got a demonstration that the system's accountability mechanisms actually work, that a corrupt president can be removed through constitutional process. That's not a revolution in the systemic sense, it's a revolution in the normative sense.
That's arguably the best case scenario. The system demonstrates that it can correct itself, which restores some trust without requiring the massive uncertainty of constitutional redesign.
Here's the thing, Moon Jae-in's successor is now in power, and South Korea's political polarization is as intense as ever. The structural problems, the Keeble dominance of the economy, the winner, take all presidential system, the regional polarization, none of that was resolved by the candlelight revolution. It was a personnel change, not a system change.
It was a reminder that even the most basic public good, getting to work, was subject to market logic that ordinary Chileans had no control over. The fare hike crystallized decades of accumulated frustration with a system that felt designed by and for an elite.
The protests forced the political class to respond. In October 2020, Chile held a referendum. Should the country draft a new constitution? 78% voted yes, 85% turnout. It was a massive democratic mandate. Then, in May 2021, they elected a constitutional convention. And here's where it gets interesting. The convention was dominated by left-wing independents and social movement activists.
Which brings us to Israel, because this is the uncomfortable implication. Where does Israel sit on that spectrum of institutional flexibility?
It's not great. Israel has no formal constitution. The basic laws serve as a quasi-constitutional framework, but they can be amended by a simple Knesset majority. There's no entrenched Bill of Rights. It produced a draft constitution in July 2022, 388 articles. It would have enshrined rights to housing, education, internet access, clean air.
A stalemate isn't stability. It's two forces pushing against each other with nothing moving. Voters rejected it.
62% voted against, 38% in favor, in a mandatory referendum with 85% turnout. It wasn't close, and the reasons are instructive. Many Chileans found the draft too long, too radical, too disconnected from what they actually wanted. The plurinational language alienated centrists.
Israel's institutions are flexible enough to be destabilized, but not flexible enough to reform. That's almost the worst combination. You get the uncertainty of crisis without the mechanism for resolution.
Those cases show us what can happen when a protest movement hits a system. But what about when the revolution actually succeeds in changing the system? That's where things get even more complicated.
But what happened in practice was that the left-wing bloc had enough votes to block anything they didn't like, and they used that leverage to push through provisions that the center and right found unacceptable. The two-thirds rule, which was supposed to force compromise, instead enabled a kind of ideological hostage-taking. The result was a document that represented the convention's majority, but not the electorate.
The process restarted. A second convention was elected, this time dominated by the right. It produced a more conservative, more moderate draft. And in December 2023, voters rejected that one too. In 2022, he pushes through a new constitution that concentrates power in the presidency and removes most checks and balances. A referendum approved it with 94%, but turnout was under 31%.
The same constitution, the same document that was supposed to be the foundation of democratic Tunisia, just didn't hold.
The revolutionary trap. Movements that succeed in removing a government or discrediting an old system often fail to produce a viable alternative because the coalition that forms to say no can't agree on what to say yes to. The political class that drafted it, the Ennahda Party, the secularist parties, they spent the next 7 years fighting over everything, failing to deliver economic growth, failing to build trust in the institutions the constitution created. By the time Saeed made his move, the public was so exhausted by the paralysis that a significant portion was willing to accept authoritarianism if it meant the garbage got collected.
The garbage crisis theory of democratic collapse. It sounds reductive, but it's not wrong. People will tolerate a lot of democratic messiness if their material conditions are improving. Let's talk about South Korea, because that's the third path.
South Korea's Candlelight Revolution is one of the most remarkable protest movements in modern democratic history. In late 2016, investigative journalists uncovered that President Park Geun-hye had been sharing classified government documents with Choi Soon Sil, a family friend with no government position, no security clearance, and a background in shamanistic cults.
Tunisia is the cautionary tale for the write a new constitution approach. You can write the most beautiful document in the world, but if the enforcement mechanisms aren't there, it's a promissory note from a bankrupt institution.
Iceland is the other fascinating case. 2008, the financial crisis hits. all three major banks collapse. The currency tanks, the stock market drops 90%. The details are stranger than any fiction, but the core was straightforward. The highest office in the country had been captured by private corruption, and the response was extraordinary.
I'm not even going to pretend I pronounced that correctly.
That's in a country of 51 million people. Roughly one in every 30 South Koreans was in the street that day. A constitutional council of 25 citizens, elected from a pool of over 500 candidates. They draft a constitution using input from the public via social media, Facebook, Twitter, a dedicated website. It's the most democratic constitution drafting process in history.
The discipline was the message.
Parliament never ratified it. It died in committee. The political class looked at this document produced by citizens and said, essentially, thanks, we'll take it from here. And then they didn't take it from here. The Constitution remains the same provisional one from 1944, which is basically Denmark's Constitution with the names changed.
The crowdsourced Constitution was a radical democratic experiment that produced a document the political class couldn't accept, and the result was...
Here's the interesting part. Iceland did reform, just not constitutionally. They prosecuted bankers, 36 of them went to prison, they imposed capital controls and restructured the banks. They replaced the central bank governor. They created a special prosecutor's office for financial crimes. The system changed incrementally through legislation and personnel changes, without touching the constitutional framework.
That reform failed to gain bipartisan support and was abandoned. The cable reform efforts largely stalled.
This is the part that should keep us up at night. The cable, these massive family-controlled conglomerates like Samsung, Hyundai, SK Group, they were at the center of the corruption scandal. Choi Soon-sil was shaking them down for money that flowed back to the president. The public was furious. Moon Jae-in campaigned on breaking the cable's political power.
Iceland's path was, don't change the constitution, change the people and the practices. It's the opposite of Tunisia's path. Write a new constitution, but don't change the people or the practices. And it worked better.
Which brings us to the question the prompt is really asking. What would a democratic revolution in Israel actually look like? What are the options?
So South Korea is the case where mass protests successfully removed a corrupt leader, held an election, installed a reformist government, and a decade later, the underlying problems are all still there. It's what the judicial overhaul protests were implicitly demanding. Not just stop the government, but build a framework the government can break.
It's like treating the symptom and not the disease, except the disease is embedded in the institutional DNA. These aren't technical questions. They're identity questions that would ignite every cleavage in Israeli society simultaneously.
Chile, mass distress leads to a genuine constitutional process that collapses twice, leaving the old system in place by default.
Option 2, electoral reform. Raise the electoral threshold further. It's currently at 3.25%, which already eliminated the smaller Arab parties from running independently. Each of these outcomes was shaped by specific institutional factors. Hungary had a parliamentary system where a party with a supermajority can rewrite the constitution.
This is the one I find most interesting, because it directly addresses the core problem, that the political class is accountable to party lists, not to voters. Now let's bring this back to Israel and ask, which path is most likely here?
Israel's institutional landscape is unique in ways that make all three paths possible, but none of them straightforward. Let's start with the most obvious structural fact. Israel has no constitution. You're redrawing the political map in a way that inevitably advantages some groups over others, and everyone knows it.
Option 3. A presidential system with separation of powers. Directly elected president, independent of the Knesset, with a fixed term. This is what the American system does, and it's been proposed in Israel before.
Then David Ben-Gurion decided he preferred parliamentary supremacy without constitutional constraints, and the moment was lost. Instead, Israel has a series of basic laws passed by the Knesset over decades. And here's the critical point. Most basic laws can be amended or repealed by a simple majority vote.
Any temporary coalition can rewrite the rules of the game.
The basic law, the Knesset from 1958, which governs the electoral system, can be changed by a simple majority. The basic law, the government, which defines executive power, can be changed by a simple majority. There's no entrenched Bill of Rights. There's no supermajority requirement for constitutional change.
What does all this mean for someone watching Israel right now? Let me give you two concrete things to look for.
The first is institutional flexibility. The most successful democratic revolutions, South Korea, Chile's moderate path, were those where existing institutions had enough give to absorb protest energy and channel it into reform. That's exactly what makes the current moment so structurally unstable. The coalition has the votes to pass basic law amendments. They've already done it. The judicial reform legislation in 2023 was passed as an amendment to basic law, the judiciary, and it was passed with a simple majority.
The protests in 2023 were enormous. Over 600,000 people at the peak on March 11th, the largest protest in Israeli history. But as you noted earlier, those protests were reactive. They were about defending the status quo. Specifically, defending the Supreme Court's power of judicial review. They weren't about proposing a new constitutional vision. The slogan was, "Save the court, not write a constitution." The current opposition parties frame their opposition in national terms because that's what the system rewards. The electoral system doesn't select for competent administrators. It selects for ideological brand managers.
We would manage the war better. We would keep Israel safer. They don't offer a vision for depoliticizing the civil service. They don't talk about electoral reform. They don't propose a written constitution that would entrench civil rights and judicial independence. They're campaigning to be better managers of the same broken system.
Because proposing systemic reform would require them to alienate potential coalition partners who benefit from the current system. It's not about replacing one set of ideological warriors with another. It's about whether governance itself can become politically salient.
Any civil service reform would be opposed by every party that uses ministry appointments as patronage. Any constitutional entrenchment would be opposed by anyone who thinks their side might need to change the rules later. So the opposition doesn't propose these things because the math of coalition building punishes anyone who does. You don't cut shelter funding unless the logic of patronage has completely displaced the logic of governance.
The childcare subsidy expansion is the other side of the same coin. It's not a policy decision. It's a coalition payment. The government isn't asking, what does the country need? It's asking, what do we need to do to keep our majority? Those are different questions with different answers, and the gap between them is the measure of democratic decay.
The open question, and this is where I think the prompt leaves us, is whether Israel is heading toward a Chilean-style constitutional moment, a Lebanese-style frozen crisis, or something entirely its own. Then there was the 2026 governance bill proposed by a handful of opposition MKs.
The next 12 to 18 months are critical. If the government survives without a major crisis, the system will likely continue its slow decay. The budget will get more distorted, the civil service more politicized, the judiciary more besieged. It won't collapse. It'll just get worse in ways that become normal.
If a trigger event happens, and this is the thing about triggers, they're unpredictable by definition, then the quiet sentiment we're seeing in the polling becomes active sentiment. 62% of right-wing voters dissatisfied, up from 48% in 3 months. That's not a blip, that's a trend. And trends that steep don't stay quiet forever.
The rest of the time, it prevents exactly the kind of coalition-toppling chaos that defines Israeli politics. You can't just destroy. You have to build. Because that last one, the same but better demand, is the most common revolutionary demand in history, and it almost never produces systemic change.
That's the tension at the heart of this whole discussion. What would a democratic revolution in Israel actually require? Let's be specific. Mass anger without institutional flexibility produces Lebanon. Mass anger with institutional flexibility produces South Korea. Mass anger channeled into constitutional design produces Chile, and then sometimes the voters reject the design.
Second, electoral reform to reduce the power of small sectarian bodies. The current 3.25% threshold is one of the lowest among OECD democracies. It means a party with 4 seats can hold the entire government hostage.
That's the thing to watch for. Not the big ideological battles. Those have been happening for decades, and they haven't changed the system. Watch for the small thing that crystallizes the diffuse anger. Watch for whether the institutions can respond. And watch for whether anyone in the political class is willing to talk about governance instead of identity.
If you want to pay attention to where governance actually happens, look at local elections and municipal politics. That's where you can see whether the system still serves citizens or has become entirely a theater of ideology, which they will never do. The ultra-Orthodox parties will never vote to raise the electoral threshold because it would threaten their seat count. The Arab parties won't either, for the same reason.
In the early Renaissance, European naturalists who first encountered descriptions of naked mole rats refused to believe they were mammals, classifying them as a species of cold-blooded insect that had entered into a parasitic relationship with the African continent itself, a misconception that persisted in some bestiaries until the 16th century.
I have so many follow-up questions that I'm afraid to ask.
The yeshiva exemption from military service isn't just a policy preference, it's the foundation of a way of life. If you raise the electoral threshold and reduce their Knesset representation, you reduce their ability to protect that exemption.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by the inscrutable Hilbert Flumingtop. We have a system that can't reform itself, a ruling coalition that's alienating even its own base, an opposition that offers no systemic alternative, and a protest movement that has historically been reactive rather than proactive.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.